Ann, are you on? And Ashley, is it okay to get started? This is Dave C.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Dave. Yes.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and get started. I wonder if folks from the methods panel, if you're on or, you know, didn't hang up and you're back on, or you're back on from dialing in, if you could just give us a hello, just so we have a sense of how many folks are on the line. Or operator, if you could give us a sense.
Or you can raise your hand and lower it, too.
Oh, perfect, Dave. That's a great idea.
If that was Ashley, by the way, your voice is very distant.
It was. Thank you. Let me try to fix my headset here.
That was a little better, actually. Maybe just speak up. I've seen about 5 or 6 hands go up. Mike Stoto is sending a message saying he's back. I think we can get started, people will join in. And this first topic for the second half of the morning, or early afternoon. To a large extent is a continuation of the previous discussion, particularly that part of the discussion in the previous section that related to reliability demonstrated for a specific purpose. But this specific question came actually from... Hello?
Hi, could we have folks to the line for the operator? I'm not sure if you could help us with the muting. That'd be great.
Thank you. Thanks. So although Sam Simon...
No, that's not ours. No, sorry.
That might be Jack. Is that Jack's voice?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
I don't think he realizes.
Could everyone who's speaking please mute their lines?
Okay, let's try again. So welcome back. And we're going to talk about relationship between reliability and validity. It may be a shortened session because we covered this topic to some degree in the previous session. But this was a specific question that came from Alex, actually, although Sam is named on the agenda. And the discussion question was, if the measure has been shown to only be reliably be used to categorize outliers, should the validity testing mirror this use? This issue came up actually in the previous discussion. So, Alex, would you like to tee it up specifically with regard to the reliability validity question?
Sure. So this issue came up for me on several of the measures that we were evaluating. And as our previous discussion highlighted, that many of the measures the developer presented reliability for either two uses or two forms of the measure, however you want to think about it, one being the inter-unit reliability for the whole distribution of performance scores, and the other the reliability for the PIUR for the identification of extreme outliers. And we had a very rich discussion about how we should think about that. And extending it into validity, in moving on to the validity analyses and evidence that was presented, sometimes the evidence would pertain to the IUR formulation, and other times it would be constructed in such a way to map onto the PIUR formulation. So I think the general question is, how should validity evidence presented map onto the sometimes multiple forms or uses presented in the reliability analysis?
And Dave, Ann, did you have a comment you wanted to make also as part of kicking it off?
No, I think that's enough to get it started. I just was observing that I don't think in the earlier discussion we specifically linked the reliability and validity discussions, but there may not be a whole lot to add. The question seems to be if you've looked at reliability using a certain approach or a certain kind of purpose, like getting rid of outliers, should the validity testing match? But I think that's already been teed up.
Okay. Good. Okay. So the floor is open for input, discussion. It may be that people feel that this has been sufficiently discussed in the previous session. I don't see any hands up.
Yeah. I would tend to agree. I mean, if the question is should the reliability and validity analyses match, I think a reasonable answer is yes.
Hearing no objection to that reasonable answer and seeing no hands still up, we may be able to steal a little bit of time for some of the other future discussions and move things along. So last call for any comments on this issue.
I guess this is Patrick.
Go ahead.
One thing I might add is that, I think this was alluded to earlier, but in some cases, the reliability, the inter-unit or inter-provider reliability can be falsely high because the provider signal is capturing both variation in risk and variation in outcome. So if the risk portion is not dealt with appropriately, then you're essentially exaggerating the provider signal because the provider signal is capturing both features. So again, this has some implication, right? Because what it means is that these metrics of reliability are to some extent dependent on our ability to separate confounding. And I don't know how that applies to this particular question, but it may have an application. We're probably on the cutting edge of research in this field to understand it better. But we know, even for example, the Adams approach, assumes no variation in risk. It assumes that everyone has the same risk. And that's clearly not a valid assumption for outcome measures. So the Adams approach is sort of geared more towards process measures where everybody can do what they're supposed to do. And we have to be thinking a little bit differently for outcome measures.
That's a great point. Eric's got your hand up. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I must admit, speaking only of my own way of sort of processing these when I think about, hospitals or other kinds of facilities that are being evaluated, to the extent that a measure developer draws attention to outlier detection, I certainly am interested, or shall I say, maybe I should say best, I'm suspicious, of course, that outliers may actually be more likely to reflect unmeasured risk adjustment or, residual confounding. Just because of, unique sociodemographics within a particular area that a facility is located, there may be particular, sort of patient characteristics or medical phenotypes that a particular facility is concentrating on. And sometimes with administrative databases, those can be very difficult to extract. So I must admit that although I didn't think about it in this cycle as I was looking at these measures that had a profile IUR reported with them, it would be nice to see that if a measure developer proposes that a measure is focused primarily on outlier detection, that there was some evaluation or some reassurance that these outliers that are being detected also are as ably addressed by the risk adjustment scheme as sort of overall is.
Good point again. Okay, so I think we should move on. Thank you for that input. Can we move the slide to the next session? And we're going to talk now about risk adjustment. And I think that Ashley, really with a focus on social risk adjustment, but probably risk adjustment generally. And Ashley, you were going to set this up for us.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Still a little faint, but not bad.
Okay, is this better, a little bit better?
That's better, yeah.
Okay, great. Let's hold the mic a little bit closer. So with this discussion of social risk adjustment, I think we had actually a very fairly extensive discussion over email just after the evaluations were done. I think that was triggered by an article maybe that Gene shared or someone, and I think that was an initial start for this discussion, and then I think certainly after the results for the preliminary analysis were shared back, there was some more discussion amongst the panel via email about the methods panel's role in providing evaluation of social risk adjustment. I think certainly everyone understands at this point that NQF prefers that decisions around the actual factors included in the risk model, including social and clinical factors, are left to the standing committee, although we certainly recognize that S&P members will have substantial and important feedback on those factors as well, given your own backgrounds and expertise in risk adjustment and other other areas. And so we certainly want to have provide the opportunity for methods panels to give feedback to standing committees on things they should be thinking about when they're looking at the measure in totality, as they look through all of the criteria and in more detail at the clinical aspects of the measures. And I think the question then comes up, so if the methods panel is not voting, on validity, particularly with an eye on social factors, but certainly has perspectives to share, what is the best way to provide that guidance to standing committees, and how can we ensure that the standing committees are considering all the factors that were not only recommended in the NQF report, but also ensuring that developers are using methodologies and making decisions on risk adjustment that align with current guidance and research. So I'll pause there and then certainly hand it over to Dave in for comments, as he was very involved with NQF's report on social risk adjustment as one of the co-chairs. So just hand it over to you, Dave, for additional comments.
Yeah, thanks, Ashley. I'll just mention a few things specifically about the issue of social risk factors, but as Dave and Ashley both pointed out, I think the practical questions in front of us apply to risk adjustment in general. The social risk factors are just a specific example, and this was on my mind in the cycle because a couple of the measures that came to the subgroup that I was on handled a couple social factors in a certain way that raised questions for me. And then it raised the subsequent question about how do we convey that message? If we think something is not correct, how do we convey that? Where does that message go? And again, this is not new to us, so I'll do this very briefly. I think as most people know, prior to 2015, 2014, the strict policy at NQF was that social factors like poverty, homelessness, minority status could not be included as adjusters in performance measures. And then a panel was convened 2014. I was co-chair of that. We had a group of experts, kind of like the one we have gathered together today, but on experts on this issue. We had conference calls, we had meetings. We then issued a report that basically changed the policy or recommended that it be changed. And a couple of the essential things were that after we really talked this through, we said, social factors should be treated exactly the same as clinical factors in their inclusion or exclusion from risk adjustment models. There's no reason to treat them differently. Then in both cases, you think about whether the variable was present before the start of care. The fundamental concept was that if a particular variable stands the marker or somehow reflects differential quality of care, then you don't want to adjust for it because you may be adjusting away quality differences that you want to see reflected in the adjusted measure. On the other hand, if the variable reflects other influences apart from quality of care, particularly if the providers being evaluated have no control over it, you do want to adjust because then you get the clearest, least biased signal about quality of care. And so that report was issued. The CSAC and the board did change the NQF policy. So now as you see actually in the text in the materials that the developers use, they're asked to work through, is there a conceptual relationship for the variable? Is there empirical relationships, so that there's some association between a factor like poverty and measure? Usually outcomes are the ones we're talking about here. And then ultimately, is or is not included in the adjustment model. Now, what we've seen over the years is that when this report was issued, the public comment was vastly in support. All the national provider organizations, plans, everybody weighed in support. CMS weighed in against, as did six other organizations. So to this day, we still have situations where a measure is presented to us. All the background work is done, in some cases very thoroughly. Is there a conceptual relationship? Is there an empirical relationship? The answers come up, yes, yes, yes. And then in the end they say, but we choose not to include this factor like poverty because we choose to. We never see that for factors like diabetes or depression. If they seem to be associated with the outcome and it's understood that it's harder, say, to achieve good outcomes with patients with these kind of problems, they're in the adjustment models, they never get pulled out after. So there's a differential treatment. Okay, that's all just background. The reason this was on my mind in this cycle is that in a couple of specific measures I was asked to review, I thought that the analysis of some candidate social factors was wonderful. I mean, it was thorough, it was thoughtful, it brought in all the relevant data, it did careful analysis, it was great. And all of that, to my mind, said these factors should be in the adjustment model. Then the developer said, no, but we choose not to include them because we don't want to. Okay, so now my quandary as a reviewer is what I do about that. I'm not allowed to fail the measure on either reliability or validity grounds, except perhaps down Larry's line of thinking if I say this problem essentially invalidates the reliability statistics. But I'm left with the question of what do? I can write a comment, but what happens to it? So that's sort of the end of my framing, and I'm looking forward to some discussion, including from our NQF experts, about what actually can we do and what should we do in situations where we believe the risk adjustment is not appropriate, not good enough. And that would be true if it's a social factor or a clinical factor.
Well, that's a really great history and setting up of the issue. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, Dave, but I think that the core question you're asking is how can we send a message that the standing committee will hear that relates to concerns about not including social risk adjustment when it appears that it should be included. And the only sure way to have that seen would be to vote low on reliability based on what Larry has pointed out, as you said, that if the risk adjustment isn't right, then the reliability is off. But I don't know if you can tell that from a submission. So I open it up for discussion, including NQF, if you want to help guide the parameters of what's possible here or what's not possible. Mike's got his hand up. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I think this is a really important issue. I'm not quite sure I understood the issue about not risk adjustment being a reliability issue, but it certainly is a validity issue. That's why we talk about a risk adjustment in the validity section. And it seems to me that we should treat risk adjustment as either makes it valid or not valid, regardless of whether we're talking about clinical issues or socioeconomic factors. If we think and the evidence suggests that there really are socio-demographic factors that matter, and the developer doesn't want to do that, I think we could say, therefore, the method scores low on validity. Just as we would if it were on clinical characteristics.
Yeah, Dave, here, let me just, I'll channel Larry here, but he can certainly jump in. I think the connection to reliability was this idea that if you're dealing with signal-to-noise statistics, and then because you didn't do acceptable risk adjustment, some of the apparent signal is based on things other than quality, then the lack of adjustment means that the reliability statistics are inflated and therefore questionable.
Okay, thanks. This is Mike again. That clarifies, and I agree with that. But I still think that what I said holds. You know, if we think that it should be risk adjusted for whatever characteristics, and if it's not, that's a validity issue.
I'm just going to try this, Dave. See, Jack had his hand up, but apparently he's on mute. I don't know if he can speak. Jack, why don't you give it a try and then
pass. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Let me add one thing just as a matter of just so people know. I believe that Larry is not on the call right now. He had to take an hour off for a COVID situation. But he'll be back later if we want to bring him into this. But go ahead, Jack, and then it'll be Patrick and Paul.
Yeah, no, I want to, you know, just so we have consistency in where we're, you know, scoring things, I think we want to decide whether problem with risk adjustment is a reliability problem or a validity problem. I tend to think of it as a validity problem because the core of our measures for a lot of these are observed to expected. And the expected is driven by the risk adjustment. If the risk adjustment model is wrong, not doing what we think it's supposed to be doing of getting an accurate assessment, a valid assessment of expected, then the measure is not valid.
Yeah, I suspect, based upon the setup of this question on the slide, that NQF agrees with that because they did say that this would not be a basis for voting low insufficient on validity, and I think if they saw it as a reliability issue, they would have probably said reliability. I'll let them speak for themselves, but my guess is that that's probably where NQF is on this question
okay.
as well.
Well, then can we get some clarification if we're supposed to be assessing validity and we think poor risk adjustment is making the measure invalid. We haven't got the right expected count. Are we supposed to nonetheless accept the measure on validity, raise that concern, and what concerns do you want the next committee to do, put that in? How do they want us to handle this? I'm happy to handle it any way I'm told to.
Right. This is Ashley. I think there's a couple things that can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I think there's a couple things that would be potentially on the table for us. I certainly sense the frustration, and I do want to also reiterate that we do pass on so the discussion for you know each measure the. That occurs at the methods panel level is summarized and provided to the standing committee in relatively great detail. We give them the preliminary analysis, the combined PAs. We give them a summary in their worksheets when they evaluate it. And so those issues are passed on. I think certainly we could maybe find some ways internally as staff to make the issues, I think, a little more clear and stand out a little bit more. The other thing is that we had this kind of a more, I don't know if a more strange is the word, but kind of prohibition in place in terms of voting down the measure before we had the policy in place where standing committees could pull measures for discussion even if they did not pass. And so something that could potentially be on the table is, you know, we could remove, still allow the methods panel to vote as they have been as they would like to vote and that they think is in according, you know, in alignment with what they're seeing in the submission. And so the signal about the validity would be in the vote, but then, you know, standing committees would have the option to pull a measure for that reason for discussion. So that's something we could, you know, kind of, it would potentially be in that bucket of measures that could be pulled for further discussion And in that point, and at that point in time, we would certainly share the details about, you know, why the methods panel felt that that measure, you know, did not pass validity, if it was something specific to, you know, the risk adjustment or the inclusion or non-inclusion of social factors. So that's something we could consider. Again, you know, it's one of those process issues, but I think there may be some things we can do on our end, but certainly if there's other guidance that the methods panel has that for developers in particular or for standing committees as they're evaluating it, I think that would be helpful as well.
So this is Dave C. I'm just going to, I think, repeat what you said there, Ashley, but make sure that my repetition doesn't distort what you're saying. I think you're indicating that that NQF will consider a change in this position that not including social factors in a risk model should not be a basis for low and sufficient validity. And the reason you can consider that change now is that between the time this policy was written and today, you've allowed for standing committees to pull measures back in for discussion. So they would be able to pull in application that has been deemed low and sufficient on the basis of social risk adjustment or any risk adjustment for that matter. The fact that they can pull that in would enable this committee to actually go ahead and make that vote, which I think gets at Dave N's concern about not knowing how to signal this concern other than putting a comment that might not be seen.
Hi, this is April. I just wanted to sort of jump in here. So, you know, I'm sort of new to the quality measurement side, but certainly I've been here since the social risk trial started. So appreciate the background. I think, you know, I want to make sure that we have the social risk trial actually being funded. We're actually looking at measures that are coming in who have the conceptual basis. And how we're sort of thinking about that. And before we make any changes, I'd want to make sure that we're kind of tying the work that you guys do to the work that that's doing, and we can come out with organizational-wide kind of policy on social risk. So I'm not saying that we wouldn't necessarily consider having the committee, you know, as I mentioned, but I'd want to make sure that we're sort of thinking about it a little bit more broadly across the endorsement portfolio, tying it into the current work that we're doing. Before we've made sort of any policy changes. But I understand the frustration, as Ashley mentioned, about being able to do that. But I just want to kind of bring that other work in and make sure that we're thinking about it, you know, sort of holistically.
No, that's helpful. So, April, I was careful to say that consider as opposed to, you know, making the policy change here on a phone call. I think would you say that it is accurate that instead of a reconsideration of this could be done in the context of the larger picture, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's lots of discussions going on all around the tables, including with our standing committee about this issue. Right. And so I absolutely want to make that part of the discussion. So yeah.
Okay. So thank you. That's very helpful. So with that in mind, are we now on? Patrick or Paul? Patrick.
Oh.
Go ahead, Patrick, and then Paul, and then Gene.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm putting this discussion in the context of the refresher that Ashley gave us a few hours ago when I was just waking up about the validity and how we assess validity and the fact that we can take into consideration the performance characteristics of a risk adjustment model, including its discrimination, its calibration, et cetera. But we're not supposed to take into consideration the presence or absence of any specific risk factor. And, of course, as we're now talking about social determinants, that fits into that framework clearly. But obviously this is a bit of a funny distinction, right, because we know that let's say that we see from the evidence that has been presented that the model is miscalibrated with respect to low-income people, right? I mean, the natural consequence of excluding social determinants from a model where those determinants belong is that the model will now be miscalibrated for those individuals. So the absence of those factors from the risk model becomes a calibration issue. And then it becomes fair game for us to discuss, as it were. In other cases, you know, a risk model may appear to perform well. I mean, the C statistic may be, let's say, 0.75. But we know from previous published literature that the C statistic ought to be 0.85. And if they had adjusted for other things that they didn't adjust for, then it probably would have been 0.85. So, again, that leads us to say, well, even though 0.75 might be considered adequate, we know that it's not where it should be, and this means that there's residual confounding or omitted variable bias, and we have a pretty good sense what those omitted variables are, even though we're not the clinical specialists who are on the standing committee and therefore empowered to comment on the specific things that should be in the model. So I'm just saying that this idea of evaluating the overall performance of the model, including particularly its calibration as well as its discrimination, is not completely separable from this issue of what's in the model.
Thank you, Patrick. Paul?
So a few comments, some of which are going to echo things we've already said, but I don't think we need to say definitively that this is an issue of either validity or reliability. I think Larry's analysis is probably pretty sound, that a very inadequate risk model can skew your assessment of reliability. I think it is, I mean, I have to agree that it is fundamentally an issue of validity, but it can certainly impact reliability. So I don't think we need to say that it is purely an issue of one or the other. I think we can just acknowledge that it impacts both. Having said that, I guess I would strongly hope for a potential change in policy because, as other people have said, you know, if we assess the risk model and find that it's methodologically flawed and inadequate, so if we find that it's methodologically flawed and inadequate because of this particular issue, then we can't comment on it, or we can't use that to vote that it is of low validity. But if we find a methodologic issue that it's inadequate based on some other parameter, we can. It puts us in a very compromised and, you know, sort of untenable position, just as a methods group. So I think that, you know, there's a certain ambivalence right now in the policy where it has to be included and assessed, but it can't be used as a criteria. I think it really puts us in a very odd position. The final comment is, having said that, you know, this gets back to a little bit to the issue that we talked about before, so what the metric we're going to be used for. So, for example, if you elected not to put in these factors because you were going to use this metric in order to identify those sites which needed more assistance and more support and more finances, then you might specifically want to leave this metric out. I mean, excuse me, you may want to leave these parameters out for that particular reason, because you want to identify sort of underserved sites that need help. Then it might be a very compelling reason to leave it out. But, you know, if we can't know or determine what the metric is going to, exactly how the metric is going to be used, then I think we have to go back to the sort of maximal criteria. And based on maximal criteria, I think if it's the risk model is inadequate, it's inadequate.
Thank you, Paul. Gene?
Yes, hi. In the interest of complete disclosure, I was a member of the NQF panel that Dave Nerentz chaired a few years ago on social risk, social demographic risk factors, and so I come to this with a certain bias. Kind of working from the bottom up in terms of the questions on the screen, not all risk factors have an equal impact on an outcome or a provider's ability to achieve an outcome with a patient. And as the number of risk factors increases, and I had examples this time around where there were, you know, in excess of 100 risk factors that were used in the equation for the prediction equation, well, obviously, no single risk factor is going to make that much difference. So I think the rationale provided by some of the developers that, well, it only accounted for 1% of the difference, and so that's not much, so we're going to ignore it, one of these socio-demographic risk factors, is bogus, because when you put 100 risk factors into an equation, individually, there isn't going to be a lot of change with any individual risk factor adding it in. Stepwise might show something different. The second question that's asked is the decision to include or exclude based on or in the provider's control. I call this the developer. So in many cases, the developers did a really excellent job of showing that, in fact, there is a relationship between a patient risk factor of which the patient or the provider has no control over, such as maybe the availability of healthcare institutions in this area or nutrition or whatever, but then simply decides not to do it. Well, the developer can simply ignore the suggestion, I think it's stronger than a suggestion, the directive from the NQF that socio-demographic risk factors be included in a prediction model for risk adjustment, then, you know, what the teeth is there in terms of having them acknowledge the fact that hospitals, for example, that deal with patients who are primarily homeless are going to have poor risk factors if you're not adjusting for whether or not they have a permanent residence. Now, we're not asking them to correct the problem of homelessness, but we are simply saying that the outcomes that the provider can achieve is directly affected by these kinds of risk factors. And finally, I agree with the previous presenter or caller that said it's not validity or reliability, it's both, primarily in my mind validity. And if we're asking, if these measures are being used to make distinctions among providers, not just in terms of the quality of their work, but also in terms of whether or not they get rewarded monetarily, and there's a lot of value-based purchasing measures out there, then we need to enforce in some way that when you demonstrate that there is a relationship between the socio-demographic risk factor and an outcome, that those need to be included just as the clinical risk factors would expect to be included. I'm sorry to prolong.
No problem, Gene. Great points. Thank you. Christy's got your hand up. Go ahead, Christy. You may be on mute, Christy, or can you try to unmute yourself?
We'll work with Christy to make sure she's connected.
I think we'll do some offline, you know, some on the side work to see if she's muted remotely, and then we'll come back to you, Christy. Jennifer has your hand up. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay. Great. Sorry, multiple phones ringing here. One concern I have with some of the socio-demographic risk factors is that they often require bringing in external and new data. They're not necessarily native to the core data source like claims or surveys. And we rarely see what missing data gets introduced into the mix because of these factors being added. So are there missing data elements? Does the effective sample size go down when you tie these measures in? That's just something I feel like we never get good visibility on, and maybe it's a non-issue. It's sort of in this space, but a little bit tangential. I just wanted to raise it.
Okay, thank you. I guess Chrissy's going to be trying to dial back in to a number that allows us to hear her. Any other comments?
Yeah, Dave in here. Just a quick response to April, and at least in my framing of this issue and the questions I raised, I wasn't seeking in any way to change brought into our policy or to get out of line with broader discussions of policy about social risk factors. It was really about how to implement the policy currently in place, where developers are asked under certain criteria to include social risk factors if a set of criteria are met. And our question is, as the methods panel, what action can we take and what decisions can we make if the treatment isn't satisfactory according to the policies that currently exist? So, again, not pushing for any change that's out of line.
If I could just, this is Dave C. I don't know if Ashley or April want to say anything to that, but if I'm not mistaken, at least one of the seven submissions we'll talk about will come up in that context. So even though it's good to know that NQF is going to take this up under kind of a more general set of issues that are under review and discussion, we will be hoping for some guidance during this meeting, specifically when these come up. When this comes up again in a specific measure context. Still haven't seen Christy join in, so we'll go to Eric and then Jack.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. So go ahead, Christy, you're up next.
All right. Yep, I had to call me and I could hear, but I couldn't speak, I guess. I just wanted to reinforce everything that folks have just said. This has been a thorn in my side since we started this process, and it seems to be getting worse, not better. And I just wanted to bring it home with a real example. Well, there are many in the measures I evaluated this round, but there were some cost measures, and yeah, they did a great job, as you said, you know, laying out the conceptual basis. They found that the social risk factors were significant, and when they presented the data, this kind of actually showed what the difference was, say, for. And these are cost measures. So the cost for a dual eligible patient in a skilled nursing facility is 18% higher. You know, a cost for a non-white in a skilled nursing facility was 25% higher. But then they said, yeah, we already have 120 variables in the model, and this doesn't improve the model fit. What does that say about those skilled nursing facilities operating on very tight margins who have 14 to 25% higher costs, who are treating, you know, patients with these social risk factors? Is it going to hurt the quality of care, or is it really going to impact access to care for those people? So in this case, and the variables were significant even in the model. It wasn't even like, oh, we added them in at the end, and of course they didn't add any, you know, no. They weren't significant. They were significant in the model. So there's something wrong with the model, right, when you have that big of a variance in cost for these groups, but you're not finding that in the risk adjustment model. So something wrong here. There was absolutely zero rationale, as far as I could tell, to not include them. But you're right; they just said, "But we're not." They decided not to. So I think we need to do something about those kinds of situations.
Well, that really brings it home. Is that one you're referring to? One of the seven we'll be discussing.
I don't think we're going to discuss this measure. It's the Pack-Smith measure. I think they passed. These measures passed because they had decent, you know, validity, reliability, which kills you to make those judgments when you know they're not being appropriately specified.
question. That really does bring it home, Christy. Thank you.
Yeah.
Eric?
Yeah.
Hi. This topic absolutely tortures me, and part of it is because I've got training in epi and I've got training in biostats, and the two parts of my brain don't really totally agree on this one. And then complicating the fact is, you know, that the when I think about these social risk factors, definitely my mind always goes toward in the denominator of patients who are Medicare eligible or Medicare enrolled, the simple binary factor of just what the previous example, are you also enrolled in Medicaid, yes or no? And so that's the easiest one for me to think about. Obviously, there's lots of other social risk factors that could be used, and some of them are measured on a continuous gradient. And you can the methodological challenges become more severe. I guess a few thoughts. One, I want not to forget is just reacting to the text on the screen, and that is that question of the word control. This is the second, I guess it's the second to last bullet point. I find that the notion of control is pretty context dependent. And what I mean is, imagine that you're concerned about something like food supply or about home security. Home security may be a poorer example than food supply, but you can imagine how there are, depending on which provider is being evaluated as a measure, maybe it's a healthcare provider, or maybe it's a Medicare Advantage plan sponsor. There are genuinely different statutory restrictions about what can be controlled in the home for a patient or for a person, depending on who the actor is that's being evaluated. And so there's a part of me that says, and I don't know if the word control or in the provider's control, I don't recall. I have read the report from the NQF before, but I don't recall if that specific language is part of the policy or it's invoked in the report. I think that it's tough to ask, say, the scientific methods panel to opine, or even a measure developer, maybe, to opine on whether something ought to be in control or not, unless you have a really detailed knowledge of what the legal restrictions are about what's in control. I mean, Medicare Advantage plan sponsors, by virtue of the 21st Century Cure Act, have the ability to do certain things now with respect to social risk factors, food security, that they didn't have the province for before. So you can imagine that this becomes complicated. I'm definitely receptive. So that's kind of that's the policy part of me. The biostat part of me says, if you know that among your list of risk factors that explain your outcome, dual eligibility is a prognostic factor, then it's kind of a black and white decision for me. It should be in the model. And I suppose that my judgment there is partly because of this lack of clarity about what's in control versus what's not in control. I mean, it's easy to talk about a social risk factor and pretend that we think that this is something that's exogenous to the system and that, you know, you can make a principled argument that you should be treating people who are poor the same way that you treat people who are not poor. But couldn't you make the same argument rather easily about a lot of comorbid conditions? If you have a drug therapy, would you make a distinction between heart failure, yes or no, diabetes, yes or no? I find that when I think very critically about this question of whether there's something truly distinctive about those risk factors, I often find myself eventually asking, well, is there actually anything different? Or is the same ethical decisions in play for a comorbid risk factor as for a social risk factor? So then the distinction begins to wash away. And then I guess that on a related note to all of that is that when it comes to the volume of risk factors in a risk adjustment scheme, I mean, no doubt with administrative databases, you're going to consistently find that poverty is associated, you know, dichotomous continuous gradient, it's going to be associated with poor outcomes. But I often find that, to some degree, when you see that independent adjusted association of, say, dual eligibility with a poor outcome, there's often a connection between the strength of that association and how many other medical factors are in the model. And sometimes I think that we concentrate in the social risk factor when actually it's a proxy for poor adjustment for a lot of other medical risk factors. And that's why I bring it up at the exact same time as talking about the distinction between social and medical risk factors, because from a statistical perspective, I'm not sure that we're looking at anything other than a large collection of very interrelated correlated factors. So that's the biostat part of me that's speaking. Finally, the epi part, and then I'll wrap up. Again, One of the things I'm struck by is that if we were to accept that we should include social risk factors, if we know that there are good data that support an association between them and outcomes, would it be reasonable or is it overstepping for this evaluation process with measures to encourage that when measures are reported, they aren't simply reported en masse with an adjustment for social risk factors, but that the measure is also reported in those who are poor and not poor, those who are dual and not dual, so that you have an opportunity to see not only the risk-adjusted perspective, given the world as it is, how is the provider doing, but also understanding for that provider what is their difference in outcomes between poor and not poor, so that you can begin to understand whether that delta is actually unique for that provider versus other providers.
Kind of like reporting actual observed means and modeled means in a paper.
Yeah.
Dave Ann here. That actually was one of the specific recommendations of the 2014 panel report.
To report both?
Yeah, that, to max informed value, that if it makes sense on all the criteria to do adjustment and use adjusted measures, that's fine. That's good, and that was a change in past NCREF policy, but also then a parallel recommendation listed right in there is to encourage reporting of, referred to it as stratified rates. That's basically what was just said, that depending on what the variable is and what the relevant categories are, report out performance in that stratified fashion. Now, it's not always feasible because of cell size issues and a few other considerations, but as a concept, yes, it's desirable. Now, that, gets us into this territory of use and reporting and who mandates the reporting and that sort of thing. But we did agree clearly as a concept it's an important and good idea.
Eric, did the epidemiologist part of you get to finish?
Oh, yeah. That was my last part.
Okay. And we heard from three Erics. You said epi and biostats, but we also heard from the policy, Eric, so thank you. This is a great expose. Now, Jack had his hand up, but I don't see it up now. It would be next if you do want to speak, and then Larry is on. So, Larry, welcome back.
Yeah, my hand was up. My hand was up, and somehow the screen seems to keep lowering it. So
somebody doesn't want you to talk, Jack. It must be that.
Right. Okay. Very rich discussion, and I think a discussion of risk adjustment in general, dealing with issues of what's downstream, what's under the control of providers, is particularly for some of the cost measures which look downstream 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, is valid, but I'm going to stick with social risk adjustment for the moment. And I think there are a couple of things we've been seeing in these measures. The reason for we're not going to add it is it doesn't add very much to the predictions. The R-square doesn't change very much. The relative rankings of folks don't change very, very much. And by very much, what I really mean is what we're told is the R-square changes virtually not at all, and the rankings change virtually not at all. So we're basically saying if we throw these in, it's de minimis. And I think it's useful to reflect a little bit on why that's the case and how it's affecting the rankings of providers. One of the reasons is some of the things that the social risk factors do are downstream from and included in the models through other downstream variables. So we've got mediated relationships. The marginal contribution of the risk factors to the outcomes are smaller than the total contribution of the risk factors to the total through all the different pathways. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why that 15, Christy's comment about $15 higher and so forth. That's, I think, one of the reasons why. But the second reason is we're only looking at Medicare data. This issue keeps coming up in the CMS measures. And we're only looking at Medicare data. And what we know about the facilities, particularly the facilities that treat high volume either minority patients or SES, low SES patients, is they tend to have smaller volumes of Medicare. So we're looking at a small contribution, a small volume in these providers, adding to our uncertainty, but also you're going to see higher volumes of Medicare patients, including some in not particularly low SES serving providers, where some of the low SES folks are there, and you're going to see the balance there. The concern that drives a lot of the are we being unfair to low SES serving providers is about their capacity to provide the kinds of services and meet the kinds of needs that their patient loads have. But an awful lot of the patients that we're concerned about are not Medicare. So we've got this real imbalance between a small number of Medicare patients in those facilities, and they're not the only ones whose care we're worried about. And the Medicare quality is focused on just the Medicare patients. So we've got this small contribution to R square, the small changes in ranking, being driven by the fact that we also have smaller numbers of Medicare patients in those low SES serving facilities. And frankly, and I've been told this by a couple of folks who run these folks, given the small number of Medicare, given that they're often paid by Medicaid lump sums or per diem, they don't do as good a job coding, which means at the same time you get some of the SES coding there, you may have lower risk adjustment scores on the other factors that influence the risk adjustment because all their comorbidities are not being coded up. So we've got a broader issue of should we be just including this as a matter of principle? Should we including it? Should we be not including it because it doesn't change the R square very much? And that I think has been some of the context in which we've seen these measures discussed by the developers and where we've had to figure out what we want to do about it.
Thanks, Jack. Larry, you're up.
Great. I'm sorry I missed a good 30 minutes of this discussion, but I'll make a couple comments, and I'll try to be succinct. The first one is that at some level, whether or not to include SES is not so much a statistical question, it's a philosophical question. So if you believe that socially disadvantaged patients are more likely to have worse outcomes and to incur higher costs, and you believe that institutions, hospitals that care for these people are being potentially financially disadvantaged with these performance measures that do not account for SES, then and then you end up hurting those more vulnerable institutions that are taking care of the most vulnerable populations. And philosophically, I think it makes sense that when that social demographic information is available, that it should be included in the risk adjustment period. So that's the first point. The second point is that I agree that the standard approach that CMS and some of the other measure developers have used is they'll put SES in the model and they'll look at overall model performance and they say it doesn't change. And then what they'll do is, again, they'll put SES in the model. They'll create two different models, one with SES, one without. And then they'll compare hospital rankings overall and they'll say it doesn't change, it doesn't matter, we're not doing it. I think maybe a more pragmatic approach and one that we could maybe discuss would be to say, okay, you know, you have 2,500 hospitals, it probably isn't going to make much of a difference for those overall for that population of 2,500 different hospitals. But if you were to limit your comparison to, say, safety net hospitals, those hospitals that, say, have more than, top 10 percentile or top quartile in terms of their proportion of socially disadvantaged patients, and then see how much of an effect including SES has on the rankings for that particular group of hospitals. And then, you know, if it has a significant impact, then you ought to include it. The problem is I think it'd be hard to come up with a cutoff for how much the rankings have to change. But I think if we could sort of maybe talk about that a little bit, that might be one way to get around that. But again, philosophically, there really is no cost to the measure developer to including social demographic risk factors if they're already in the data. And I think although people have debated back and forth whether you should include them or not include them, and I'm not going to get into that whole discussion, I think most people, at least what I'm hearing, are falling into the camp that, yeah, you ought to include them. So why not, as a group, why shouldn't the NQF say, look, you know, if you have that data element, and certainly CMS does, you ought to put it in the model, period. Thank you.
Oh, what a rich discussion that's been. I don't see any other. Oh, no, I see another. I see Paul's hand up. So go ahead, Paul.
Just to put the, you know, there is a quantitative metric that you could use called the net preclassification index, which does have certain parameters attached to it that you could actually see what would be the impact in terms of reclassification by including it in the model, which may be more meaningful than how it changes the fee statistic, which frequently is minimal, because the fee statistic deals with the overall population, but not necessarily with the impact on individual sites.
Elaborating on Larry's point. Thank you, Paul. Sherry? Can't hear you, Sherry. Did you call into the 833 number? Seems to me you need to call the 833 number to be able to be heard. Why don't we wait and see if Sherry's going to maybe redial. She sent a note saying she's back on the call, but maybe came in through the other number. Quite a rich discussion. I see Christy and Paul have hands raised. I think those are recycled raised hands, so let's check. Christy, do you have a comment?
I just had one quick other comment, and that was that I also saw a couple of measures this cycle where they made just the opposite argument for including some clinical factors that didn't show statistical significance in the model, but they kept them in purely for face validity, which we know
mm-hmm.
has been done for a long time. I like to, you know, when you talk out both sides of your mouth kind of thing. So.
Well, I think it goes back to, I think it was Eric's point that, you know, at the end of the day, there's not as much a difference between social risk adjustment and clinical risk adjustment, and they are correlated risk factors, at least from a statistical perspective. So it's hard to make the case that one's more important than the other. I still don't see Sherry back. She says she called the 833 number and unmuted my line, but still can't be heard.
Hi, Sherry. Mm-hmm. Try hitting *1. See if that gets you on.
Still don't hear her. I assume she heard you saying hit *1. Let's go to Dan, Daniel, and we'll see if Sherry's found her way in. Go ahead, Dan.
Thanks. Just a couple of notes. First, as a general perspective, I think, at least from my perspective, I'd like to see developers first test for SES factors as is actually currently expected. Now, we do have, sometimes I've seen, you know, with my little experience on this panel, some cases where they just say, we don't have any SES data. So I think we also need to address this situation. So what do we do about that? Is that okay? Because that's a really easy way to get around that. Just say we don't have the data. So are we expecting, or will NQF be expecting in a certain amount of time for every measure development to get SES data and test for it? That's one question. Another thing I think is that if once an SES factor has been identified as significant, whether it contributes more or less to the predictive power of the model, I can think of very good reasons not to include it. and in the model. And I just want to give an example. There are studies that show that an SES factor, let's say, rate is significant, but is no longer significant once treatments are adjusted for. So I think that's the case where a developer should really be careful about including an SES factor that goes away once a treatment are adjusted for. And there could be multiple reasons for that. Maybe low SES patients get worse treatments for some reason that's not really dependent on the overall resources. Maybe it's just the selection of treatments that's different. And there are studies that show that. But in that case, I would expect the developer to provide evidence to support that, not just throw out a philosophical argument that's not supported by evidence. Those were my two comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. We're going to check back with Sherry again, who's going to try and speak. Go ahead, Sherry.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you are.
Sorry about that. I think they entered me as a non-presenter. I just wanted to back up and agree completely with Larry about the need to sort of the face validity question, if you will, of including socioeconomic status data where it's available in the data source. And that is, there's evidence from a number of studies, some of them are older, that academic medical centers and public health and public hospitals are disproportionately represented in the penalty arena for adjusted compensation by by CMS. So I think, you know, some of the argument is, well, you don't have some of the you know, case mix variables should adjust for all the argument that poor people are sicker, but in fact, there's a lot of evidence that, for example, the area deprivation index in our local situation moves hospitals around in terms of the distribution. So I think that with just a blanket, you need empirical evidence question. You know, does the empirical evidence support it? In this day and age, probably isn't adequate. I mean, there's a fair amount of opinion out there that this should and does matter. Just from a philosophical standpoint, I think that warrants the at least watch what the look at the adjustment, see if it's costly, and there's probably no reason not to, if possible, do it.
This is Dave C. again. A quick note that we're being reminded, and this, I don't think it's a surprise to Sherry, but the use of a speakerphone is not encouraged because it's harder to get a good quality tape recording. So if you can avoid using a speakerphone when you're speaking, please do. The other thing I wanted to say is that I think this has been a fascinating and very rich discussion from several people who have thought deeply about this topic. And a note to NQF, I think, is that I think it's a fair summary to say that there is a lot more support for including social risk adjustment than for not including it, even if the delta in the R-squared is not substantially changed, although I don't think that's everyone's opinion, but I think I heard more in favor of including it, at least on philosophical grounds and also even on statistical grounds in terms of having a common, you know, similar standing with clinical risk factor adjustment. So I think it's a fair summary to say that the majority of the committee does endorse NQF going back to look at this, as April said, in the larger context, and maybe letting us know in our next meeting where you are with that. Understanding that Dave N. raised this not to start a revolution, but it did stimulate quite a discussion. And so with knowledge that Dave's motive was really to get guidance on how to respond now to these submissions, it does raise the larger policy issue, and it's good to know NQF is paying attention to it, and we'll be revisiting this with standing committees and internally. Is that a fair summary?
Sure. Hi, Dave. It's Ashley. I think that was a great summary. And I did also just want to note that, you know, I think there are things that we can be doing at NQF, to Dave's point about not starting a revolution, to make sure that both developers and committee members and NQF staff really understand what the current policy is under the trial. And so I think we can do more on our end to make sure that that's communicated and to make sure that the policy is accurately kind of carried out and applied in the measure evaluations at the standing committee discussions as well. So thank you for that summary, and agreed it was very very great.
And I think it's probably not appropriate for me to volunteer people, but you know, you heard from at least a dozen people who have obviously thought a lot about this and can be helpful, I think, to you in going forward with your thinking about it. In the meantime, I would ask everyone to keep this discussion and the earlier discussions from the morning in mind as we do go through the submissions that we have to vote on as the meeting progresses. So we're still sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, Dave, and really quickly, did you already start an outline for this topic? I know you had mentioned that you had started taking some notes and had some ideas about a paper. Is there something that you already have in mind, and should folks reach out if they are interested in helping you with that?
Yes, that's right. I was motivated just to put some things on paper as I was doing some reviews of measures that I thought were needed some kind of discussion made about inadequate risk adjustment. And so maybe if it's just the process, if people want to let me know if they're interested in being part of the writing group, I can send around at least what I've got getting started. I wanted to hold it pending this discussion this morning and just see where people were coming from and who seemed engaged in the issue and if there was a general direction where we were going. We can pick it up from there if there are folks who are interested.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's proceed on to the next topic on the agenda. If you can advance to the next slide, it's on cost measure evaluation challenges. And I think Jack and Jennifer were tagged for teeing this up and helping to set up the discussion. Jack and Jennifer, do you want to walk us through this?
Sure. Dave, I'm going to give just a quick tee up, and then I'll have Jack and Jen and actually D. John share some thoughts.
Sure.
They were part of a recent discussion with the Cost and Efficiency Standing Committee. But I tagged Jack in particular because he emailed these issues, so definitely would appreciate his input on expanding on some of these questions that are here on the slide. But I did just want to give a little bit of context. Cost measures obviously come to the Scientific Methods Panel for evaluations. We got 6 this cycle. We are anticipating seeing at least a handful of measures every cycle going forward. I think CMS is working on developing several measures that will be submitted to NQF over the next several cycles. So this will be kind of a mainstay in our portfolio going forward. And so I think it is certainly important to have some principles that underpin our evaluations for these to make sure there's a common understanding of how we're approaching the evaluation for these. And I think that the Cost and Efficiency Standing Committee is grappling with some of the same issues. Many of them are, you know, economists and methodologists as well as clinicians. And I think the understanding that we actually put together a call just a couple weeks ago with them to discuss some of the challenges, particularly in evaluating validity, based on some of the concerns that were raised in the spring around the validity testing for some of those measures. So we had, I think, a really great discussion with the Cost and Efficiency Committee. In addition to the issues listed here, I did want to kind of offer an opportunity for Bijan and Jen and Jack to share some of their takeaways from that discussion and maybe summarize some of the issues here on the slide for us.
Great, Jack.
Okay, so I'm just talking about the evaluating exclusions issue. I've got two bullet points on this page, but just the evaluating exclusions issue. We see something in the submissions that I do not recall seeing before. I mean, we've got a number of these submissions where there's an index event, and then we're going to look at all the things that happen 3 months, 6 months. I think we've got one that's 9 months out, and sort of attribute that to the provider at the incident event. And I'm not arguing about that logic. That's a whole other subject. But what they said in the specifications of a number of these is we have excluded certain downstream events that the committee, our technical expert panel, and the CMS docs judge outside of the control of the incident provider. It might be, you know, one of them was planned readmission, which makes a lot of sense. But the issue that I had as a reviewer of these things is I had no idea how the process of identifying the costs for exclusion as outside of control or otherwise predictable were being done. Was there a systematic review of possible things? Did they say yes to this one and no to that one, and we did not see the no's? Is it an ad hoc process where somebody says, well, I think this could happen and we ought to exclude it? And only the ones where somebody said this could happen, we ought to exclude it, sort of got on the agenda for discussion. And none of that is clear in the documentation we've gotten. So it's hard to evaluate whether the exclusions look reasonable, but I don't know what they've decided has not been excluded or how systematic that review is, so I don't know how good the exclusion process is. And that was the concern I was raising.
I would raise a different exclusion issue, sticking with this concept of the episode or bundle of care. Jack is mentioning sort of exclusions within the construct, things that are not counted when you're thinking about the cost or the quality of care. But another type of exclusion is episodes themselves that get dropped from analysis. And we have seen measures where something like less than 10% of the originally triggered cases remain in the final measure. And we see somewhere it's small, 5 or 10% dropout, and somewhere it's tremendous. And again, not much understanding of what is left on the cutting room floor when you have those degree of dramatic exclusions. So just a different take, same theme.
Well, this is Dave C. I mean, I confess that I was, you know, when I looked at exclusions, I kind of had my clinical trialist hat on and thought in terms of, you know, did this exclusion seem reasonable based upon the kind of underlying rules that I might use for deciding whether or not a exclusion from eligibility in a clinical trial or excluding from an outcome determination in the trial made sense. And so, you know, it kind of brought me to that provider control issue. If it seemed like a cost that was legitimately wasn't a major cost or was something that was outside of the provider control, it seemed reasonable. But I agree. I never saw it spelled out. I was using other sort of internal models.
Yeah, if I can, this is Jackie again, if I can just think about it, I totally agree with you. The exclusions we've seen to me as a non-clinician have all made reasonable sense. It's more of how systematic is this review, and how, you know, what didn't get excluded, and, you know, how, you know, again, it's a matter of how the process is done, which is not being mentioned. The exclusions themselves that we've seen all look reasonable.
Right. Yeah. So you're not actually concerned about a specific case, per se, but, the process. And Paul's got his hand up.
So, echoing Dave's sort of clinical trials hat, I'm just wondering if thinking in terms of like a construct diagram, if maybe, I didn't actually have to review any one of these, but it seems to me that if you had a concept of what was the total population that was potentially, theoretically at risk, and then having them demonstrate each exclusion, what percentage or what number were they excluded with the reason, and then what was the final study, you know, in sort of the format of a construct diagram that you would do for a clinical trial. It might, to Jack's point, it might make things a lot clearer as to what you're doing. Then you could make a better judgment as to whether or not the exclusion seemed reasonable or not, or even if the extent of the exclusion seemed reasonable, the process would be a lot clearer.
That's a good suggestion. Any other comments or questions on the evaluating exclusions component of this? Larry.
So, just listening to this discussion, and I did not evaluate any cost measures. When I saw on the agenda that we were going to be looking at exclusions, I assumed that what we were going to be looking at is if you have outliers in terms of cost and how to deal with those. Are we saying that extreme outliers of cost are being excluded from the risk adjustment model, or are they being excluded from the population sample, the patient sample that's, whose cost performance is being evaluated, one or both or none? What are we exactly talking about with respect to exclusions? Can you make it a little bit more concrete for me?
On the high-cost cases, what we tend to see is linearization. The high-cost outliers aren't excluded. They're truncated and sort of capped at the 99th percentile or the 95th percentile. So that would tend to be the issue there. It doesn't drive the case to be dropped. We're talking about, I think, two kinds of exclusions. One, in counting up the cost of producing a certain kind of care, or measuring the kind of utilization, some kinds of utilization and costs are just excluded on theoretical grounds. We couldn't control car accidents. Physicians should not be held responsible for a patient who has a car accident on day 60 after knee surgery. That really is beyond anyone's control and should be excluded. Someone
with
organ transplant. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's, Jack, if I've got it right, those are the
right
internal exclusions.
Yes, that's right. The measure, the definition is exclusion of unrelated expenses. And in none of the cases was the car accident 3 months after the surgery included as one of the excluded cases, excluded expenses. So, nor did it exclude the case. I'm looking, I've got to go back to the document. In my notes, I did not document what the exclusions, examples of the exclusions, and I'd have to go back to the original submission to go see what they did. It's one of and the appendices that they reference were actually not in our documentation. So there we are. The language showed up in, among other measures, 3564, Medicare spending per beneficiary, post-acute measure for home health, as an example.
Go ahead, Stan.
Go ahead,
yeah. And then Larry after that.
Okay, thanks.
I just was going to say the other type of exclusion in the skilled nursing facility space, for example, that concerns me is cases that get dropped. So let's say you have a skilled nursing facility stay and there's a transfer to a new facility or some other kind of similar event. Those cases will, as a whole, will be dropped. And to me, a concern is whether that's introducing bias into the sample of cases that are left. Is it really a valid measure of skilled nursing stay costs, for example, if I've excluded half of all cases constructed using the logic? So back to, I think, Larry, you were asking with the high cost, there are other things besides costs that lead to cases being dropped, characteristics of the episode itself, besides being an outlier.
Larry?
Sorry, I just wanted to...
Yeah, sure. Thanks. That was Jen, right?
Yeah, that was Jen.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Larry?
And that was exactly the question that I had in terms of maybe some examples of where there was concern about the cases being excluded or being inappropriately excluded. You can deal with exclusions by just including them as risk factors. So, you know, transferring a hospital transfer in. Instead of excluding those, you may just want to put it in as a risk factor in your risk adjustment model. And it, what I'm hearing, it doesn't sound like what you're dealing with is all that different from exclusion in other types of models. Am I missing something? For other types of measures, rather.
Yeah, what you're missing from me is the concern that I have no idea how things get on the agenda for considering being excluded as an unrelated cost, and therefore how systematic the process is or how random this is in terms of the validity of the measure. If you're going to start saying we're going to exclude unrelated costs, then you need to tell me how you're making decisions to consider whether costs are related or unrelated, and that's not in the documentation at all, and it's not clear how systematic it is.
Got it. Thank you.
I would raise a separate issue, which in cost measures, there is tremendous variance, right? The outliers are extreme, and dropping cases really helps a measure with reliability and validity. If you can narrow the set of cases to be more homogenous and similar, you're going to have a better performing cost measure in terms of the things we've been talking about throughout this day. But in the process of narrowing that scope, you're leaving a lot of cases behind. And my concern is little attention given to what's left out and what that remaining set truly represents. If we have 17% of cases of SNF care in the country used to assess the resource use for SNF care, is that really a valid measure? This is a validity question for me in a lot of ways. So I just wanted to raise a different point than the one that Jack's making, which is also obviously important. And I think other measures obviously have these problems as well, but for me, cost measures are very challenging as freestanding individual episodes of care. They don't lend themselves well to being standalone, highly reliable, highly valid measures.
This is Dave C. I'm sort of torn between whether we're requesting guidance or whether we're nominating ourselves to help with this algorithm, whether consort diagram or some sort of explicit request for an explicit articulation of the basis for exclusion.
One of my thoughts when we met with the standing committee was that it would be helpful to do a white paper on some of the unique features and challenges of reliability and validity of cost measures. So I was hoping to nominate this as sort of a white paper topic, which could include diagrammatic examples like we were talking about as one dimension. So I think we're raising issues that we would like developers to be aware of. I'm not sure there's a short-term action, but Jack, Bijan, others.
Would just like more documentation of the process by which costs are, you know, services are nominated as unrelated to care and how they're evaluated, and a little bit of whether a decision has been made to not exclude some costs, just to get a better feel for the process here. It's part of my assessment of whether the process for putting the measure together has been valid.
This is Dave C. again. I'm sorry if I missed this. Is there a standing committee for cost measures?
Yes, there
yes.
is. This is Ashley. Yes.
And Bijan and Jen and Jack are on it?
Bijan and Jack are. Jen, we invited as a guest of honor to our webinar a couple weeks ago, yes.
So maybe this committee could weigh in on endorsing the proposal to that standing committee to please do that white paper. Sounds like it's more their purview than ours. But we would appreciate the guidance. Is that fair?
Hi, this is Ashley. I actually think it's probably a crossover. I think there are some issues that they're grappling with methodologically that they actually would like guidance from the methods panel on. Some were around, I think, the main issue that we discussed on the webinar a couple weeks ago was around validity testing, and particularly for claims-based cost measures and how, you know, developers should be thinking about picking comparators and whether or not there's any kind of systematic you know, bias or error created by using another measure of comparing a cost administrative claims-based cost measure to another claims-based cost measure to demonstrate validity and kind of what types of validity were they're actually demonstrating by using that approach. And so I think there's definitely some methodological questions that have come up at the committee level that I think they are seeking some broader guidance from a group like the methods panel. So, Jen, please feel free to add or clarify my explanation if there's sure you can probably explain it much more.
No, I think that's perfect.
What do people think about maybe some kind of joint committee or subcommittee that would have representation from the cost standing committee and the SMP? And identify what are the you know, four or five issues, and if not a white paper, write a at least write down some preliminary recommendations that we can then discuss.
This is Ashley. I think that would be great, and I certainly would be happy to help gather folks across both committees and bring you guys together so that there's a group that's focused on that.
Jack and Jen and Bijan, but you said Jack and Bijan are the members of that standing committee?
Yes,
that's right.
I think one of you or both of you would be logical leaders of this because you have feet and you have a foot in both committees. If you'd be willing to, chair such a subcommittee to get the issues down on paper and convene people that are willing to weigh in on the requests that they have of us and that we have of them, because it sounds like the requests are going both ways. Is that reasonable?
Hear, hear.
Yeah, this is Bijan. I'll be happy to.
Oh, that's
sure.
So, Ashley, should we leave this with NQF staff to coordinate a gathering of, you know, I don't know what the number is, but 6 to 8 people or so to come up with, identifying the issues and then drafting some position for each one?
Sure, we can. Sure, we can. We can certainly work on getting folks together for that. No problem.
And then we can decide later whether this is something we can circulate through email discussion or for the next meeting, depending on its urgency.
Yes, that sounds good.
Okay. Any other? I don't see any other hands up. Are there any other thoughts on the topic? Well, we're.
Dave, sorry, just real quick. I just wanted to know if Jack, did you want to just provide before we move on? Because we're ahead of schedule and we can break early and give folks a longer break. I am sensitive to the start time of measure evaluation since we've already coordinated that with the developer. So I'd like to stick to our schedule for measure evaluation. But Jack, if you want to just quickly, since we have a few extra minutes, just to explain the second bullet around the risk adjustment, and then if folks have questions, we can, but just understanding that we are, that can be a subtopic of the paper for folks who are interested in having more in-depth discussion.
Sure. Second bullet. To expect more tailoring. Oh, this is the tailoring issue. So what we've seen in particularly the CMS cost measures is, and to some extent some of the other measures as well, is they migrated to a highly stylized, fairly standard way of approaching the risk adjuster. Hierarchical HCCs, some specific clinical services, some interactions there. But then they're applying, and it's always a look back, right? Sometimes they include the diagnosis for the condition that creates the incident event, sometimes not. But the other elements of the risk adjuster are always a look back based upon review of the full records from the patient. So we wind up with one of the sources of exclusion is we don't have a full year of data before the incident event. But there's not a lot of tailoring. And and you keep seeing this language when they're doing the risk adjustment on 1 million patients or 100,000 patients or several 100,000 patients, that we don't want to add interactions and we don't want to do this or that because we're concerned about overfitting. And even a model with 200 variables is not overfit on 100,000 or 200,000 patients. There may be specific issues of low cell counts, but it doesn't look like that. And so there's a tendency to not want to do a lot of tailoring to the specific service that's being examined or the specific providers that are being examined, and the question is whether we should expect more tailoring of the risk adjuster to the patients and care circumstances. And in the case of the Medicare spending per beneficiary in one example, they've got month-to-month estimates which they average, but they don't take into account the hit by the bus or the new cancer diagnosis during the period in which things are being located. They don't think about why did patients get into rehab and do we need to make sure we've got specific measures of some of the variants in rehab that how people get into rehab that leads to differences in cost downstream from the initial rehab circumstances. And that's the question of how much tailoring we should be expecting versus just saying they're using the standard risk adjuster. We know that sometimes it explains 30% of the variance and sometimes it explains 11, and we shouldn't be worrying about what they could do to push the 11% of variance up to a higher number. Those were the issues that sort of occurred to me as I was looking across the measures we've been getting as opposed to individual specific measures.
Thanks, Jack. I see that Gene raised his hand maybe even before you started speaking, and then Eric.
Yes, I was just concerned that we're not going to get a chance to talk about risk adjustment. The problem that I saw, and I was part of the cost measure review team, was that there appeared to be a fair amount of what I would call cut and paste that went on across the four measures, the mean spending per beneficiary that were presented. And perhaps the problem is simply that the developer was not very careful in terms of this cut-and-paste methodology. The one that really upset me had to do with home health, the mean spending per beneficiary for home health care. In that description, they say that the data for the patient is being taken from the MDS instrument. I can assure you, having spent 20 years doing home health analysis, that no patient in home health has been evaluated using the MDS. They use the OASIS instrument, and the items are not the same on those two instruments. To claim that the model that they're using for home health, the home health mean spending per beneficiary, that takes into consideration the clinical condition of the home health patient using MDS is completely bogus. It just can't happen because those data don't exist. That obviously upset me. The other piece that that I was concerned about, and it didn't have to do specifically with risk adjustment, was it was not clear what the meaning of the mean spending per beneficiary value was supposed to be. They, at the end of their presentations, showed that the data that they generated using their little models were normally distributed, and they looked, you know, like a typical normal distribution. Yet when they were going to be reporting the results were U-shaped. That is, the lowest percentage of patients or units of performance, whether it's a SNF or a home health or an IRF or a long-term care facility, were U-shaped. That is, there were fewest people, percentage of agencies or facilities that were in the middle, and the largest percentages were either below the normal, below expectations, or above expectations. And I found it very confusing because how this set up, what the criteria we used to transform the normal distribution into a U-shaped distribution were not quite clear. I'll end it there.
Thanks, Jim. Eric?
Hi. This is an interesting topic. So I was on a subgroup that did not, to my knowledge or memory, did not evaluate any cost measures. So I'm definitely not speaking to anything that's in front of the panel this cycle, at least in front of my subgroup. I will say that this has been an interesting thing I've observed in watching some of these Medicare cost measures being developed, and not so much through the NQF forum, but, you know, particularly through a variety of the payment mechanisms and models that have been proposed, especially from the Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center, the CMMI. historically, I've been accustomed to seeing a lot of cost measures being developed by academic groups that are working in contract with the government, with CMS. So they might be Yale, might be University of Michigan. Some of these big contractors do a lot of measure development. Typically speaking, my impression has always been that they are tailoring the risk adjustment scheme to the disease state or to the application that they are evaluating. What I have noticed with the Center for Innovation is that they are, generally speaking, I'm making a lot of generalizations, they're gravitating toward this blanket use of the HCC risk score. And definitely, the HCC risk score has got different components, right? There's a component for general Medicare beneficiary. There's one for ESRD. There are ones for people who are a full year of prior eligibility, less than a full year. So there's some level of tailoring to different subsets of phenotypes. But the bottom line is that they're taking this generalized risk score, which was developed for evaluating cost expectations, and it was developed on fee-for-service data and is typically used for risk-adjusting Medicare Advantage data, but then they're using it in all sorts of applications, from general to specific. And interestingly enough, I even encountered an example specific to my disease state, dialysis, where the Innovation Center had actually proposed a payment model last summer where the outcome was home dialysis utilization. So we're actually talking about a clinical outcome being risk-adjusted with the HCC risk score. And I think to myself, well, now this is really daring because this isn't even an economic outcome anymore. It seems to me that the question, from my perspective, comes down to a validity question. And so I don't mean to become overly polemical about this. You've got a risk score that has been developed for a specific application, say the HCC risk score. It can be used, as any covariate can be used, in a variety of analyses and risk adjustment models. You know, the Charlson risk score, the Ehlinghaus scores, or adaptations of Ehlinghaus are used in widespread scenarios. We know that those scores weren't necessarily perfectly intended for each specific application, but they're used widely. So I don't mean to say that this should be treated any differently, but I do think that it comes down to a question of validity. Does this risk score that was not tailored for your application provide appropriate resolution? And to my mind, the answer is yes or no, depending on what the nature of the economic outcome is. If it's a general outcome, like total all-cost spending across Parts A and B, I'm okay with it in general. You know, it'd be good to see evidence before I say I'm okay specifically, but I'm okay in general. When it comes to very specific instances like episode payments of care, now I think the stakes are higher, and I think that you do want to have some awareness of what was happening before that episode began, what triggered that episode. And my concern then becomes that these generalized risk scores not being tailored to the application are going to explain a lot less of the variation. And as a result, the measure is going to be a lot less valid. So I think it comes down to, if I were to really boil it down for me, it would be, yes, we should expect tailoring if we're evaluating a very sort of short-term, highly specific kind of cost endpoint. If it's all cost over a one-year time period, then I'm expecting less tailoring.
Thank you, Eric. Christy?
Yeah, this is a measure that we are going to discuss tomorrow that didn't pass, but I just wanted to point out inconsistency in using those HCC risk models and all of the ICD codes in those models to risk adjust this measure. But then because they wanted to apply it to both Medicare fee-for-service and Medicare Advantage, they elected to only use diagnoses from the discharge claim for a patient, which we all know is in no way going to document every chronic condition that patient has. And then it wasn't even clear if they're actually using history for Medicare fee-for-service patients because they have it, but they're not using it for Medicare Advantage because they don't have it because they included some adjustment factors for Medicare Advantage. But just the whole point of you develop the model using this huge set of data that assumes, you know, that you're going to be accounting for chronic conditions that patients have when you risk adjust, but then when you limit that to whatever diagnoses that were deemed important on that discharge claim, that patient could very well have multiple other chronic conditions that aren't captured, and so then the results are going to be highly skewed. So the measure didn't pass, but
just this whole approach of using different data to develop the model, the risk adjustment model, than you're using to actually calculate the measure seems completely inappropriate. So there should be some kind of rule against that. Maybe there is.
Thank you, Christy. I don't see any other hands up. Wait, Larry just raised his hand. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, this is a really quick follow-up question to Jack and Christy. When they're using a CMS HCP model in their cost models, and I understand that it was developed in a different data set, are they estimating new coefficients for the CMS HCP models for the individual categories, or are they re-estimating a single coefficient for the entire score based on the old coefficients? I mean, they must be doing some kind of customization. Can you?
The customization is in terms of whether they're including or excluding certain covariates. They're then taking the data and they're running the regressions with all the covariates that they're including, and you get measure specific coefficients for each measure. So the risk adjustment is being done there.
Yeah, so they are customizing the model, and that's a fairly standard approach. I mean, certainly the CMS HCC model is much, much richer than more traditional models like the Ellickhauser comorbidity algorithm that's used repeatedly in the outcomes literature. So can you explain to me why you feel that their approach is not sufficient? I mean, it's a very, very rich model with lots of different
tools.
It's been very well careful.
It's because the model was developed, I think appropriately, as you said, using all of the ICD-10 for the past year of history for that patient. But then when they calculate the measure, in this case, they were only using ICDs from a discharge, from an inpatient claim, from an inpatient discharge claim. That in no way is going to capture all the ICD diagnoses for that patient for the past 12 months, right? That was the biggest problem.
Is that the CMS HCC model goes back and uses the carrier data as well. So it uses not just inpatient, but also outpatient.
That's right. It uses a history, a one-year history of claims to calculate the HCC risk score. Yep.
So what is the major limitation of using the CMS HCC model for cost?
We looked at measures in this last cycle, and I haven't got the full list in front of me, and I apologize by name. But we looked at measures for home health, patients who had been admitted to home health, patients who had been admitted to SNF, patients who had been admitted to rehab. And there were a couple of others. They don't always include the incident diagnosis that brought the patient in. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. There's no thinking about the exclusions are an effort to think about what could happen to these patients downstream that are costs that we would want to exclude. But the risk adjustment model, and as I said, I'm not sure those are inclusive enough. But the risk adjustment model doesn't always capture all the things that are unique to the patient's circumstances that brought them into rehab or brought them into the SNF that might affect downstream cost and utilization. It's this look back, and it sort of ignores there's information in the fact this patient went into a SNF. And patients go into SNF for different reasons. So not always clear to me that they have fully captured the patient, the circumstances that brought the patient into care that may affect downstream costs. That's my concern. And it's a concern that's driven by the fact that the models are not the models are being standardized, even if the coefficients are different. The models are being standardized. And the question is, should there be more tailoring? And I don't have an answer to that. I raised it because I'm torn and uncertain about this.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there something about the way the CMS HCC models are created that the categories are hierarchical categories, and so they do look at the full set of ICD codes, both inpatient and outpatient, and they group them in such a way that the ones that are most likely associated with higher costs are given more importance.
Yes, but that's exactly right, and that's fairly general. So now we've had a patient who has had a joint replacement and wound up in rehab, or wound up in a skilled nursing facility which is providing rehab services. But if the other things that are in that hierarchy are not directly related, you know, in some sense they get classified up because of something other than the joint replacement, the fact that the condition that created the incident event was joint replacement sort of gets lost.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay, so this is Dave C. again. So this issue and risk adjustment, as well as exclusions and other topics that have been brought up by the standing committee, will be placed with the subcommittee that anyone can volunteer to be considered for, and we'll do that through NQF, and Ashley will set that up after the meeting, presumably. We have hit the time where we're no longer ahead of schedule, but we're still on schedule, and it's time to go to public comment, and then we'll take a break. I'm not sure how to open up for public comment, but maybe the operator is listening.
And if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
Thank you. Those who would like to make a comment can also enter your comment into the chat box, and we'll make sure it is read and responded to by the message panel. Thank you.
Okay, so star one, or type a note into the chat box, lower left of your screen.
Likewise, if you're on the webinar, you can raise your hand, and we'll acknowledge you that way, too, and at least we'll know that you have a question.
And again, in order to ask an audio question, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. And at this time, there are no audio questions.
Thank you. I don't see anything in the chat room. I don't see any hands raised either.
Okay, great. Sure. Thanks, Dave, Stella, for leading us through that discussion. Again, very interesting and thoughtful, and we're looking forward to getting some folks together to write some papers and dive a little bit deeper into these topics and share some guidance going forward. So we are due for our second break. It is another hour, and we will reconvene at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time to conclude our meeting with discussion of two measures. Measure 3559, hospital-level risk standardized improvement rate and inpatient reported outcome following elective primary total hip and or total knee arthroplasty by Yale Core CMS. And the other measure is 0715, standardized adverse event ratio for children less than 18 years of age undergoing cardiac catheterization by Boston Children's Hospital. We expect that the developers will be joining us at that time, and we'll come back to discuss those two measures to the end, and that will conclude our day one. So barring any questions at this point, we will go ahead and break and reconvene at 3:30.
Ashley, just want to say, see again, just a note that Colette Pitson has typed in a comment. It doesn't require a response, but just let people know there's a comment that has been added. Dave, and can you just hang on for a minute?
This is Sherry. Can I ask one quick question?
Sure.
Is it, given the difficulties that in redialing in, is it better to hang up or stay on the line?
You can stay on the line.
Okay, thanks.
You can stay on.
Yep, if you stay on, just make sure your phone is muted, please. So,
yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome to stay on and stay on the webinar as well. Thank you.
Okay, bye. Bye, everyone. Dave, are you there?
Still here, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to ask if you could lead the next session, because it's my subcommittee, and I
sure.
have comments. So I'd rather be a commenter than an impartial moderator.
absolutely fine, no problem at all.
All right, good. Talk to you in an hour.
Oh, you can't. Oh, Jesus.